The Guardian.
Hello. Yes, please, take a seat. No, not that one. It's my mum's. My name's Paul McInnes. Welcome to Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. And set for release from the traps, we have unlikely drum and bass emo crossover merchants Pendulum, new musical directions from Portishead, Alex Turner and White Williams, new Rosie Swash.
Hello.
New friends, new comments, new opinions on Noel Gallagher. And we also have this motley duo.
Dan Lesak and Scroobius Pip first made their name last spring with Thou Shall Always Kill, a homemade effort that got more than 1 million views on YouTube. They went on to build their reputation with a sterling plod through a summer of sudden festivals and a Radiohead sampling follow-up Letter From God to Man. Now as they embark on another summer of touring, they're about to release their debut LP, Angles.
That's Dan Lesak and Scroobius Pip, whose Thou Shalt Always Kill, which not the worship of false idols and getting down to the sound of the wickedness, came out last year. It was a memorable tune, but also one that seemed destined for one-hit wonder territory. Then Dan Lesak on beats and Scroobius Pip on lyrics began to attract crowds wherever they played, and their music found an audience too. So it was that when I met them in London this week, I could ask them about their debut LP and whether it was the first ever spoken word breakbeat album.
Could well be. I don't know. There's got to be someone who's done it first. You can't be truly original in this day and age.
Nah.
I can't think of it, though.
Well, people would, as someone pointed out at a gig recently, that A Faithless was totally spoken word, but no one really twigged it because it was so dancey. But would that come in, I don't know, the dance terms, you see, that wouldn't
that's
come breakbeat at all, would it?
It's, no, yeah, that's...
Four to the floor, isn't it?
Four to the floor,
is that what it's
four
called?
Four to the floor.
Brilliant.
If you were to be looking back at the lineage of the music that's kind of come to form what you do, who would you point out?
It sounds really cheesy, but it's like Tree Roots. It's so sparse, it's so spread out, you know, because obviously he's taken, Pip's side's taken influence from jazz, hip-hop, punk, girly pop, you know, all that. And then obviously my side's got the electro, the dance stuff, but then the electronica and even going back into the Kraftwerks and your Cans and all that. So it's really, the lineage is like a proper family tree, you know, it's really spread out.
It's good that, I mean, I said this in an interview the other day and it was off the cuff then, but now it is a pre-prepared nice analogy. I mean, it's just like with hip-hop, it developed all this way and then it got to a point where it doesn't feel as if it can develop much further. So with hopefully what we're kind of doing and a fair few other acts is kind of going back a few branches and trying a different route. So it's going back to like your Gil Scott Heron kind of area where it was spoken word, it was jazzy hip-hop. It's kind of let's try another direction off of that as opposed to trying to develop from, you know, someone who's been shot 9 times or whatever. You can't develop on that.
Every now and then I cower and I need to find empowerment. Empowerment is paramount to how I can begin to man a plan that I can implement to make it then on ignorance. Instead of drunk belligerent dissidents and miscreants, especially in this instance, with a never ending persistence to use words in excellence as if they were blunt instruments to beat a hole in their defence. There's beauty in their innocence which serves to build resistance despite of all my good intent. Beats that my heart skipped.
What were you two doing before you came to start recording stuff together?
Almost exactly what we're doing now, but not together, because I was making beats and a lot of electronic stuff, probably a bit more noodly than I am now. But
I was doing spoken word over more like a jazzy, more hip-hoppy beats kind of thing. And before that, we were both doing exactly the same as well, because we were working in the same HMV. So, really, so literally exactly the same every day was...
Which HMV is that?
That was HMV Lakeside. And then we went on to different HMVs. So Dan went to Reading, I went to Beckton. There was
I might
a lot of
have
development.
Spent a small amount of time in Staines and Bayswater.
Since I left, which was probably 4 years ago now, I can honestly say I've been back at the most 5 times. I just can't stand to go there.
Idiot.
I think it's because the only shop I used to like going to was HMV, and now I don't have a 30% discount. I can't get through the front door. I start seeing prices and thinking, no, that's the actual price. It's not that minus 30%.
And so you came together, your eyes met over a crowded dub reggae aisle, and then you come to start making music together. But it's a, you know, you're coming from very different parts of the musical spectrum. How do you work together when you're recording?
Again, completely separately. It's all basically, I can go off and write stuff and I'll send him a load of MP3s and he'll say, oh, I like that one, I got a lyric for it.
Normally I'll say, can you send him on a disc? I don't know how to download stuff. My computer's broken or my internet's down.
So postal.
And then I said, if Dan's made something, I'll then see if I've got anything I'm working on that will fit it. Or, I mean, often Dan has to put up with texts from me saying, I've got this idea, I need this beat that's like dark and then it goes grey and then it turns a little bit red, and just really he has to then come up with whatever I'm talking about, so that works nicely.
Don't get me wrong, I ain't dissing Dizzy Rascal, I'm just using this beat as a single example. It was the first big hit of its kind in the pop charts, and all the last shit with profit in mind and not hard. Channel U's full of
UK sounds ringtone.
Then they should all have U45s to bring home, prancing about like they're the next big thing, because their cousin's got an 8-track and they make Daryl can sing.
So is that how it worked on the album? Because there's the track Fixed, which is a riff on the Dizzy Rascal.
Fixed is kind of a break from the rule.
People often say, question, you know, what structure we go for and how many bars and that kind of thing. That, it was, I looped it as long as I could keep it looped, and then I brought the hook back in. So there's no structure or plan, and then I wrote in that gap. But yeah, that and Letter From God To Man were both, when I was writing them, I had these loops and these beats in mind. And then I sent them off to Dan, and he turned it into something a million times better than I... had conceived.
I'd like to ask you, Scroobius, Pip, what you see the distinction being between spoken word poetry and rapping?
I don't feel there has to be a distinction. I mean, there's a lot of acts like Sage Francis and Saul Williams who opened it up to me that you can be both spoken word and hip-hop and MCing. But the mass public think of hip-hop as 50 Cent and Kanye West and that kind of thing. So if we're going from that version of hip hop and the, you know, our version of spoken word, it's just putting more content in and being trying to tell stories with, you know, a reason for telling them that aren't just here's stuff that happened to me. It's like thinking, why does this deserve to be told? And if it's warranted, then presenting it in a good way. And a rapping is often a much more about flow, and most rappers will have a far better flow than any of us are spoken word schmucks. But it's because on our ones, it's more about what words we're using in the content. So we have to then fit that into a flow as opposed to have this tight flow already.
You've got this kind of really a devoted live following. Do you feel that that's because people are connecting with the thing you're trying to do content-wise as well as sound-wise?
See, I think they really are. I mean, it's really shocked us the amount of people who, you know, it's not just messages saying, I like your stuff. I said again, people are really, they will message about specific lyrics, specific tracks, and really get quite, you know, that much more involved because we touch on some quite heavy subjects. And I think if you've had any experience of some of them subjects, it's instantly going to connect. It's going to be a deeper connection than you would just to a song that makes you dance.
My name is Billy and I've been beaten since I was 3. Mum died when I was born, so Dad takes it out on me. He ain't a bad man. He just gets drunk and feels alone. I tend to go for a walk and he's asleep when I get home. I don't like to talk about it much because, as I said, it ain't his fault. It only happens when he's drunk as a last resort. I wanted to get him a gift to kind of show my support, but I had no money and I stole and then I guess I got caught. At times like that, I kind of switch off my mind, stare blankly into space and let what happens unwind. That seemed to anger this guard. He put his hands around my neck, said it's time for me to learn some manners and respect. It hurt, but I've had worse before. But it made me realise life was just a series of wars. I went straight home that day and locked the bathroom door. Took a blade to both wrists. They won't hurt me no more.
Switching things back to you, Dan, do you ever worry that your music gets lost behind kind of people talking and thinking about the lyrics?
I'd hope not, because I think like tracks like Angles, they're complementary to the music. So maybe if they are talking about the lyrics, it's because I've hopefully done enough to emphasise what needs emphasis. It's always the way with bands anyway, that the front man, the lyricist, will get the most attention. But you're not going to listen to a band that you don't like the sound of.
I was wondering, with this, we've had, 12 months between the track and the album, I suppose, roughly.
Yeah.
Are there any more sacred cows you would have added to the list in the last 12 months?
I don't know, because it's not so much about the bands themselves. I said it's more about how fanatic the fans are. I mean, I'd probably add a Joy Division just because Dan, I've seen over the last year, is so fanatical about them that it suddenly makes them kind of, they're one of them bands that it should be.
It is just, it is always an issue when,
because it's not, it, as I said, a lot of people misinterpret it to be that's having a go at the bands. A lot of the bands in there are absolutely love and have grown up thoroughly enjoying. Yeah. It's just saying that they are just people who make music.
Yeah.
If the fans weren't that fanatical, then the band wouldn't be or what they are. If you know what I mean, we did a gig with Billy Bragg recently, and he was saying he went to the first Rock Against Racism thing, and it was like the Clash and the Specials, everyone there. And he was saying he realised that it wasn't the bands that made it special, it was being in that crowd with that them people who all felt that excited. So it was, it sounds cheesy, but it's the fans that make it that a bigger thing. And that's kind of or what the Just a Band thing's about. It's like the band are the one that focus that, but it's the buzz off all your mates going, have you heard this? Have you heard this? And the excitement of everyone else that makes them exciting.
I just wanted to ask you one contemporary question. This stuff about Jay-Z and Glastonbury, have you been hearing anything about this?
I love it. It's just people, it's just something for the press to latch onto. It's, people have become wise to the fact that they should wait to buy their Glastonbury tickets until they know who's actually playing. Knowing two bands isn't enough to spend hundreds of pounds on.
Like, you couldn't do that with a venue. Buy tickets for Saturday night's gig.
You'll
see who's playing when you get here. And it's like, you wouldn't try that. It's ridiculous.
As well, it's a big testament to the rise of the small festivals. Camp Festival, Bestival, Latitude, even the city festivals, Camden Crawl, Great Escape, they're all pulling people away from Glastonbury. You know, I would much rather spend my money on going to four festivals of a smaller nature than going to Glastonbury. Nothing, I really enjoyed Glastonbury last year, but I kind of understand now that there's more to life.
Despite all the furore, Glastonbury will sell out.
Yeah,
it just won't sell out in one day. It doesn't have to sell out in one day. It's like, that's not unreasonable.
I guarantee if Jay-Z does play, he'll still play in front of 50,000-60,000 people.
And he'll smash it.
Yeah, forever. When we headline the pyramid stage,
I think that'll bring the unity. I think that'll bring it back round. It's happened. Yeah.
And that was Dan Lesac and Scroobius Pip. Their debut album, Angles, is out next month, and the single Look for the Woman is out on April the 26th. And Fear Not will be looking to milk more from the Sean Carter cow later on. Rosie, what's your take on Dan Lesac and Scroobius Pip? Are they to your taste?
Well, we were discussing this before, weren't we? And we decided we like them. It's kind of cliche, but at least they're doing something different. And their album is genuinely really interesting to listen to, except for the fact that I would never listen to that kind of music, really, if it wasn't for the things that he's saying. And I think that Thou Shalt Not Kill is brilliant.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Rosie. No, I won't.
See ya.
But we can't spend any longer on Dan Lesac and Scroobius Pip because we must move on. Because, ultimately, we have Paul Lester kicking his heels, waiting to join us in this week's Singles Club. Hello, Paul, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've always wanted to be ultimate.
Now, where's the child? There's usually a child.
Yeah, I know, I usually have a couple of kids with me, or at least one, and but I couldn't find one to borrow on the way. No. I did stop a couple by on the Holloway Road, but they were too busy.
They're too busy holding up small shops, I imagine.
Yeah.
What?
It's my neck of the woods.
It's my neck of the woods. Well, exactly. I mean, this is what I'm basing all my evidence on. Anyway, Paul is here because he's going to help us review some of the week's new musical releases. Rosie, of course, proffers her views weekly on the site, music.guardian.co.uk, that is, for anybody who's never been there. I'm very ashamed to hear any of you who haven't. She does that every Tuesday, but this is a more collegiate take on the tunes in that everyone usually agrees to disagree with me. So let's get this process started with our first track. It's Portishead and Machine Gun. Portishead were an intangible presence at arty dinner parties across the world when they released their debut album, Dummy. Coming out in 1994, everybody bought it, everybody played it all the time, and it went on to win the Mercury Music Prize the following year. The output that followed, however, has been slightly slow in coming out. Their second album, Portishead, was released in 1997, with nothing but a live album and some solo projects following thereafter. All of that means that Machine Gun, the first single to be taken from the band's forthcoming album, Third, will be their first single release in 11 years. Rosie.
Yes.
Has it been worth the wait?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a word.
I love this. And I have heard the rest of the album and it's very good as well, but it's not like this. When I first heard it, I have to say I was a bit, oh God, because it's called Machine Gun and it sounds like a gun, and I thought, is this some kind of comment on the Iraq war or something, really? You know, I just felt a little bit...
That's you with your inquiring liberal mind. You just want to see the war everywhere.
But and it might well be, but it's not obvious that that's what it's about. And when she starts singing in that very distinctive voice of hers, and I guess the theme there is something, you know, about redemption and saviors and all that, it totally changes how I listen to it. And by the end of it, I felt a bit like it was it's a really remarkable song.
Paul, Rosie's saying that obviously, you know, Beth Gibbons' voice is very unique, and that's kind of what Portishead have always built their sound around. But the rest of the stuff, is this kind of quite different from what's gone before?
Yeah, it feels a little bit more technotronic. Certainly that track does. And I like the mix of the machinic and the choral. You used the word ultimate before. Portishead's sound was an ultimate sound, and it was kind of a question of what do they do for an encore? And Tricky had that problem with Maxine Kay, and I guess Massive Attack had the same problem. They all came out about the same time, and they were so definitive for what they were trying to do, which the term was trip-hop, but everyone seemed to be really embarrassed about really quickly, almost as embarrassing a term as Brit-pop. I think that's why they've all struggled to come up with decent follow-ups. I think... they've left it a sufficient amount of time to say this is what we were doing, and it was sort of Joy Division with a soul singer on top, and this sounded a bit like that. It sounded a bit like this is what Joy Division might have sounded like after Ian Curtis committed suicide, and they'd have roped in Alison Moyet or something like that.
No, I find it as far apart from Dommy as you might be able to imagine. If you can see that they keep the core element of Beth's voice at the heart of it all. I mean, it sounds like it's been influenced to me. It's by dubstep and grime as much as anything else.
I think, yeah, mate, there's every chance that Jeff Barrow has heard the Burial album. And I think that seems to be the album that everyone's trying to beat at the moment in that area of music anyway. And maybe that he was a little bit embarrassed about the accusations that this was, you know, edgy dinner party music, and they were trying to give it a bit more oomph and edge.
Rosie, tell us a little bit more about the album, of which you have heard some more.
It just feels so relevant to now. Like, everything that they're influenced by and that they've been listening to is new and interesting and
has
and
it got
fresh.
This industrial theme
and
in it?
No, it hasn't. It's a lot more lo-fi than that. And there's a song on it that's called Magic Doors, which I think is probably the most like something that you would have heard off Dummy. And it's got this that kind of minimalist percussion and then a really beautiful, clear melody and just her voice. But a lot of the rest of it is much more experimental, but it's really interesting. I'd love to see it live.
So you get a tiny sense of, you know, after 3 years of people saying that they're influenced by the class of 78, 79, Jeff Barrow, Portishead has gone back to those other people from 78, 79 that aren't quite as easy to assimilate into, like Throbbing Gristle, and you mentioned industrial, those clanging sounds and just the sound of the modern world.
Well, there might be a little bit more talk about 78, 79 in a minute. You never know. But Machine Gun by Portishead is out right now. Second track on Singles Club. It's New Violence by White Williams. Headprints on the prisoner's neighbour. Long nights with the pink intruder. Okay, that's White Williams with New Violence. White Williams are a band. They're headed up by Joe Williams, who is also white. Their various members hail from New York and Ohio and include a hairdresser and a cover model, apparently. What's a cover model? Somebody who's more attractive than people who get on the inside pages. Their music has been described as new wave pop, and they can count Baltimore musician Dan Deacon and influential website Pitchfork among their fans. White Williams, they're going to be touring the UK very soon and supporting Vampire Weekend, no less. Paul Lester, first of all, do you like this record?
I did like it, actually. I'm impressed that, you know, I have to say White is the new Black, because after Black Angel and Black Ghost and Black Keys Lit. And Black Kids, there's lots of bands called White. Like
White Lies, White Denim.
Well, three anyway. Yeah. So that's important, because we can almost get a movement together here. Someone should call one of the music papers. Oh, there is only one. But yeah, I thought that was quite interesting. It's basically Jonathan Richman's Modern Lovers Roadrunner with a bit of an electronic pulse running through it, which is essentially what New Wave was, or at least the poppy variety. And it is interesting that after 2 years, people are still pillaging that area. But then again, people spent probably 10 to 15 years pillaging 1965. So I think 78, 79 is due a break.
It's due a one. In a way, a lot of this feels quite familiar. But I love the packaging of it together. All these familiar elements do make something new. And it's also quite upbeat, Rosie.
Yeah, there is something about it. But again, not to talk too much about the rest of their stuff, but that, you know, there's a lot of moog and cymbals and a feeling that there's a lot of stuff being clattered about just for the joy of the sound of it, which is always going to be attractive in a record. You couldn't get more of a new wave pop record. It's so slick and it's so sort of tight and clean. But at the same time, I think what's good about White Williams is they also represent that kind of sordid underbelly that New Wave had, where everything looked so smart, but there was a lot going on underneath that wasn't so sort of, that didn't match the aesthetic.
You know, I have trouble working out lyrics, Rosie, but what's he, do you think he's talking about with the new violence? The Iraq War?
Yeah, why is everyone talking about it now? I think there's a little bit of some sexual stuff in there, and I think it's just, you know, it's imagery based rather than necessarily a theme, and there's no story to be told. I think he sounds like Joe Jackson.
He was quintessential new wave man.
There you go.
I guess, and maybe XTC. But apart from Franz Ferdinand, has there been a hit single from the new wave of new wave fraternity?
The new wave of new...
Actually, there was a new wave of new wave in the 90s, but that was wave. More punky stuff.
Block Party?
Yeah, they had a top 20 hit, is it?
Well, no, but they've had top 20 albums.
They've had top 20 hits. So Block Party and Frank, but you get a sense that this was something that there's legions of people waiting at the gates of the charts about to, you know, infiltrate, and it hasn't quite happened. But maybe this will do it.
Oh, maybe it won't. New Violence by White Williams is out now. Final track on Singles Club is Age of the Understatement by The Last Shadow Puppets. And there's a fashion to rent, the age of the understatement. Before the attraction ferments, kiss me properly and pull me apart. Affection to rent, the age of the understatement. Before this attraction ferments, kiss me properly and pull me apart. That's The Last Shadow Puppets with Age of the Understatement. The Last Shadow Puppets is the new joint side project of Arctic Monkeys man Alex Turner and Rascals' frontman Miles Kane. The pair met when Kane's previous group, the Little Flames, toured with the Arctic Monkeys in 2006. This album, The Age of the Understatement, was produced by Simian Mobile Disco's James Ford, ex-Music Weekly alumni, if a guest can be an alum, and arranged by ex-Arcade Fire violinist Owen Pallett. It's also worth pointing out that James Ford plays the drums for this band too. Rosie,
yes.
You're a fan, aren't you?
I don't think I'll ever hate anything that Alex Turner does.
This is what I
this
suspect.
This is what you don't like.
We had to have a conversation this morning. I was going, yeah, well, you know, well produced. And you go, no, the thing is, the lyrics, they chime. Anything that he does always has a connection with people.
Yeah.
They can always understand what it is he's talking about.
But you don't understand what he's
talking about. Well, I mean, by that, I kind of mean to say that you meant to say that he can kind of explain emotional situations which are common to all. I just don't understand the lyrics.
I don't particularly either, but it is his trademark to have that very quite sort of ornate style of, you know, and long-winded lyrical style, and he's always the third party and he's telling you a story about something he's seen, so it's definitely got that in it. I wouldn't say it's my favourite set of lyrics that he's ever written, but I love the speed of it more than anything else. It's just really relentless. There isn't, you don't even really feel like there's a chorus in there.
I really like that too, and that's why I wondered how much James Ford had to do with that. But for me, that kind of the not only the pace, but, you know, the images it conjures up of Clint Eastwood kind of, you know, riding through the desert. It's just a remove from these kind of cold, observed lyrics, distanced from any real emotional expression or passion.
It's almost like a cover version. When I read some of the reviews that alluded to, I think it was John Barry, it made me think of a phrase that we used to use in the music press whenever a band hired an orchestra. It was strings are the last refuge of the uninspired, with particular reference to the Verve. But I thought they worked really well here. They felt actually seamlessly integrated into the whole sound. It's an interesting pointer towards that third Arctic Monkeys album. I think now the dust has settled on the second one. I think people can safely conclude that it was just more of the same. Is that the general consensus?
No.
It's certainly the consensus around where I live. But, you know, I live in a strange part of London. But that really does make me... It whets my appetite for the third album and maybe suggests that John Barry produce that third Arctic's album. That would be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
He's still alive, isn't he?
I don't know, but if he isn't, we can just...
be even more interesting
if
he wasn't.
Reanimate him. Strap him to a big machine and get him working on that third Arctic Monkeys album.
It is weird, though, because Alex Turner, all right, he's a brainy northern lad. The bloke from the Rascals, I just thought these two blokes getting together, it was just a recipe for a 1965 fest. We mentioned, you know, the band's obsession with the Beatles and stuff. Well, I sort of alluded to that before. I thought this was just going to be an absolute geezer mania, but this isn't. This is it's delicate, it's sensitive.
But that's what I like about him is that there is that geezery side to it. You're always going to get massive groups of blokes going to Arctic Monkeys gigs, but he himself is actually really quite a sensitive.
Yeah,
and you do get the feeling that Miles Kane has been subsumed into the kind of the Turner persona.
Although it's weird, they look really alike. Mm. Although Miles Kane looks a lot like Paul McCartney in his younger days. Check it out.
Yeah.
Check it.
There you go.
Check it out.
The 65 thing continues. I think before we start drawing any more parallels and wondering whether Alex Turner is the reincarnation of John Lennon and trying to match their birth dates, we should probably move on. Age of the Understatement by The Last Shadow Puppets is out now, and the album is out in a couple of weeks, I think. You've heard our opinions. Now we want yours. Let us know your thoughts on all the tracks you've just heard, bits of, on the blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. As an example of how to do it, take a cue from SV80, who kicked off last week's blog by describing Lady Hawk as a little overwrought for my tastes. Now, that's the sort of critical acuity we're looking for, see? Frisky Dingo, he went on to take the Black Kids to task. Am I the only one that doesn't get the Black Kids? He or she wrote, I'm not impressed. I want to like them because I like the sound, but I just can't bring myself to it. I agree with Rosie that they are overproduced and it is not for the better. EJD, however, liked that single by the Black Kids, though he found the rest of the EP a bit too samey. There wasn't much in the way of positive support for Heart's Revolution either, and it was pointed out that they are pally with a woman called Corey Kennedy. That's C-O-R-Y Kennedy, as in JFK, whose Wikipedia page is definitely worth a check, if only to shake your head depressively at the state of modern celebrity. Anyway, tell us what you think of this week's tunes, and there's some more here to think about in our montage. You more like love to start shit. I'm more of the trips to Florida, order the orders, views of the water, straight from a page of your favorite author. Kanye West featuring Dwele and Flashing Lights. Always be this easy. She in the mirror dancing so sleazy. I get a call like, where are you, Yeezy? And I don't want to find it again. Bjork. Wanderlust. Nature's laws. Britney Spears. Break the ice. Stop still when Gold Fat. Happiness. We've just been having a long conversation about the incipient relationship between Peaches Geldof and Andy Gill
of the Gang of Four.
Unlikely.
Yeah. Unlikely. Look out for that one, kids. And we wouldn't have known about that if it weren't for you, Paul Lester.
See, I come here casually dressed. You never expect these pearls.
No, exactly. Just pull that out of your back pocket at a moment's notice. Each time we meet, my esteem for you grows. Thank you so much for coming in and joining us at the Singles Club today.
Thanks for having me.
That is certifiably it from this week's Singles Club. It was fun while it lasted, but you can catch the textual version each week at guardian.co.uk/music, and you can click through to watch videos too. Next on Music Weekly, drum and bass. It's a style of music that's gone in and out of fashion in its lifetime. Is it in fashion right now, Rosie?
According to WOMAD, it's just coming to fashion.
It's just coming to fashion, yeah. WOMAD, yeah. Just a little bit. WOMAD has a drum and bass tent this year, you see. But it seems like it's never had a better chance of cracking stadium territory than it does with Pendulum.
Since revitalising the drum and bass scene 4 years ago with their fast beats and trademark cracks and bass, Pendulum have become one of the biggest names in the scene. But the Australians, who have relocated from Perth to London, have their eyes on a bigger prize, now adding vocals, live instruments and a distinct rock edge that has seen their recent music, in particular the single Granite, make the crossover to daytime radio.
That's Granite by Pendulum. Originally from Australia, their base is very much in the UK now, and I caught them just before they're about to head out on tour for pretty much the entire summer, a tour that will take in Gatecrasher, Rockness and the Download Festival. I spoke to the band's main man, Rob Swire, and I asked him about the recent change in musical direction that's seen them collide drum and bass with something more rocky, and I wanted to know how that all works.
We found we were listening to a lot less drum and bass strictly and a lot less electronic stuff, and when we weren't making it, we were just listening to, you know, the bands we liked and, you know, old stuff and new stuff. And every time we heard one of those old tracks or a rock track, we thought, well, we want to take sort of the soul of that and see if we can merge it with what we'd been doing from the start.
Would you say that there's kind of a almost like an emo taste to what you do now?
I don't know if it's emo. I think that relation might just be because of emo being around at the time. I guess you could say we're influenced by a lot of that stuff now.
So which sort of rock bands are you listening to? Which bands in particular have influenced this new direction?
People like from Led Zeppelin to The Shadows to new bands out like Under Oath and lesser extent Artrayer and bands like that. Bullet for My Valentine, all that.
How did you come together as a band, and what sort of, what state is the Australian drum and bass scene?
Me and Gareth went to school together, and I'd been producing for as long as I can remember. When we left school, we sort of saw each other again after a few years and decided to see if we could put something together and make some music. And we initially tried to play it out live at a local club, and our hard drives crashed at the last minute. We couldn't do it live, so we asked one of our DJing friends to play the records out, and he told us he'd been making some music as well. We got together and made our first record.
And was it something that immediately caught on in your home country, or was it something you were always thinking, well, we might need to see how the Brits like this?
It's sort of caught on. It was weird. In Perth, the support for their own music isn't that strong. And we found that even, I think our last show had about 20 people in attendance before we moved over to the UK. But of course, when you come back, the whole thing was a lot bigger.
So you mean once you've got vindication abroad, they're taking you to your heart a bit more?
Yeah.
You see, that old colonial mentality. It's difficult to shift, mate, I tell you. So what was it, when was the point you decided to relocate to the UK?
Basically, when our label owner said that we could come and stay in his flat for free, and with the Australian to UK exchange rate, at that point, and even now, that made a lot of sense.
You cruel mercenaries, you. You're about to go, as well as the album coming up, you're about to go on a massive tour with loads of dates sold out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're an incredibly popular live act with a really loyal fan base. What is it that about your live shows that you think kind of raises you above your average dance performance?
DJ-wise, for me personally, and I know the other guy as well, it's not as rewarding at all. I mean, you're just basically at the end of the day more or less a human jukebox playing mastered tunes to a crowd. And with a lot of stuff, you know, you're putting elements together separately, you're building it up from nothing. And if you don't like the way a track came out on a record, which thank God hasn't happened yet, or if you get bored of it after a while, you can change it up every night and it keeps evolving.
And when you play your live shows, what are the tunes that go down with the fans the best? Is it still the your original kind of classics, or do they?
With our UK tour last year, we'd only had Granite out, and so the tracks which were going off the most were the old ones. But as Granite got played out, went down a lot better as the tour progressed.
One of the kind of quintessential things about you can almost pick out a pendulum track by this unique bass sound you've got. How did you get to that? How did you find that sound?
I still don't know what that sound is. It just happens. I have no idea.
Really?
Yeah. The funny thing is, people say that about the drums as well, and in every track there's different drums and a different bass sound.
Final question. Who parties harder, a superstar DJ or a rock star?
Probably neither, probably a radio DJ.
That is Rob Swire from Pendulum. What a joke cracker he is. And they're all over the country and the continent for the rest of the summer. Their new album, In Silico, will be out on May the 12th as well. We've had loads of feedback from you lot this week. It's included exchanges of dodgy beeper, 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 beeper remixes on the blog, debates about whether Holy Fuck are this decade's Stereo Lab, as described by Onion Gravy, or simply, in the words of Professor Wee2, holy moly. On Facebook, we asked for your sympathies in the Jay-Z versus Noel Gallagher battle. Jamie Smith said, "Noel, obviously, he's always right, innit?" And he was immediately followed by Jeremy Kingsley, who countered, "Oh, who really cares what Noel thinks?" Luella Forbes said, "I love what Noel said about if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Isn't that the point of putting Jay-Z as a headliner? That last year Glasgow got criticised for not going with the times and not being current enough, i.e. it's broke. How to fix it? Change what you're doing. Put Jay-Z as a headliner." To which Stephen Carr responded. In response to Luella, "Jay-Z isn't of the moment. Jay-Z had his prime time about 6 or 7 years ago. It would be just as bad if they put 50 Cent on. The whole point, as I see it, of Glasgow is to promote up-and-comers with good bands as the headliners. Oasis have had their day and they may be so-called legends, but wouldn't we all prefer someone like Muse who are still pushing boundaries? Likewise with Jay-Z. He has no longer pushed the boundaries of hip-hop. Maybe someone like Lupe would be better, but certainly not as a headline act. I think I may have rambled on here." Maybe you did, Stephen, but it was still worthwhile. Our favourite Scott in Scotland, yes, that's Scott from Scotland, pretty much brought the whole thing to an end, though, with a dry observation that's typical of the intelligence of Music Weekly listeners. "No one is right," he writes. Dan Hancock's especially. He's the guy who wrote a blog on Jay-Z this week. Go check it out on blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. "I think it was just a bit of laddish banter with the BBC guy. No in-depth analysis required." Whoa. So, post comments on this week's blog. Tell us what you made of Pendulum and Dan Lesak and Scroobius Pip and our reviews, of course. The address is blogs.guardian.co.uk/music. That, however, just about wraps it up for this week. Rosie Swash, it's been a pleasure.
As always, it's been an inspiration.
Has it been an inspiration? What does that mean? You're going to turn it into something? You're going to go out and help a granny on the way home?
I like to keep my secrets to myself.
You do, don't you? And we'll be back this same time next week. It's still a Thursday, so please do tune in. We love you all. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.